Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they infected it. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and in one moment we'll be joined, or a few moments we'll be joined by Peter Fowler, who is after a brief slash long hiatus, is back stronger than ever, and he'll be joining me in a few moments to facilitate this program today and to introduce our guest, our featured guest for the show, who is going to be none other than Carl Dix, who is a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and today we'll be discussing mass incarceration, stop frisk, and you know, and also you know the injustice that continues to swirl around the Trayvon Martin case, as well as so many other cases throughout the U.S. of police brutality, and you know, or in this case, wannabe police, you know. Brutality in the case of this so-called neighborhood watchman, George Zimmerman. So we discussed a range of things with Carl Dix, and also he'll be telling us about this important day of action surrounding mass incarceration that will be April 19th, I guess, April 19th, 2012. That is tomorrow, and you know we're looking forward to it. So without further ado, I want to welcome Peter Fowler, who is joining us live and direct from somewhere in Arizona, the hot, hot state of Arizona, otherwise known as the Mississippi of the Southwest. Peter, can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm right here, brother. Good to be with you, man.
Yeah. How's Mississippi of the Southwest doing? How's the good old state of Arizona and that regressive female troll, otherwise known as Jan Brewer, who's your who is the governor of Arizona?
It is broiling out here, and I'm not talking about the mercury. I'm talking about the politics and the politics that are being perpetrated by the regressive state. And it is the kind of politics that never ceases to amaze. But they somehow managed to pull off an incredible feat that eclipses their previous ones, and Ms. Brewer and the rest of her minions have continued to do that. So even after being out of the country for a while, I came back to find that they never let up on their regressive racist politics. So the state of Arizona is it's an interesting place to be, man. It's an interesting place to be.
Exactly. You come back and you're welcomed with another piece of injustice, you know, with a young brother, Trayvon Martin, you know, shot dead, you know, by a neighborhood watchman. And as we know, as you know, certainly that's you know, one of the cases that's been reported on mainstream, the so-called mainstream news. But we know that there have been many, many more incidents of unarmed black and brown men and women who have been, you know, shot down, killed by so-called law enforcement. So, you know, you step right back in, and you know, you're back in the cauldron. And I want to ask you, Peter, what have been your thoughts surrounding this whole Trayvon Martin case? What have been your thoughts?
A couple of thoughts in particular. Obviously, initially there's a tremendous amount of outrage and indignation and just fury that this kind of murder can continue to happen. It seems like just last week, you know, we were talking about the Oscar Grant killing in Oakland, and then the week before that about little Ayanna Stanley Jones. And, you know, I mean, here we are again having this conversation, and it seems sadly to be a broken record. But we have to realize that these are not, like you said, there are many, many incidents like them, and they continue to rage. There's another one. There was another one. I mean, there's a situation in Chicago. A young teenager was shot by the police. There's another one in Oklahoma. In fact, just the other day in Georgia, a six-year-old black girl was put in handcuffs and taken to her local police department and put in a jail cell. I mean, so this kind of thing is a daily occurrence. So that's the one thing that we have to ground ourselves in, is the reality that these are not anomalies, but these are regular everyday occurrences in the system, in the racist Americanist system. And so that's one thing, you know, to really come back down to earth and realize that, hey, this is how the system is. This is the nature of this system of America. And then the next thought was that there are, you know, to connect these dots, to connect all these dots, not just the recent dots, the ones I mentioned, but also the historical dots. And one particular historical contextual dot, Solomon, that comes to mind with the Trayvon Martin case, is the Emmett Till killing in the real Mississippi in 1955. And, you know, we see so many parallels between Emmett Till situation and the Trayvon Martin situation. And it's absolutely maddening to see that decades later, you know, half a century later, more than half a century later, we're still struggling with Emmett Till and the same kinds of cases and the same kinds of racism, the same kind of murder, and the same kind of racist so-called criminal justice system in this country. So those were the thoughts that came to my mind as I was confronted with this coming back here. And so those are constructive points of departure to really start a conversation on. And so I'm real glad to have Carl Dix on the show with us today, because we can have a conversation in a constructive direction about the Trayvon Martin situation, looking at the historical context, and then look at a constructive path forward on how to deal with this. That's kind of where my mind is right now, having been confronted with the Trayvon Martin killing right coming back home, and I'm looking forward to talking about some of these historical continuities as well as moving forward. Rather than just dwelling on the past, but let's talk about how we move forward and what we could do about this.
Right. Peter, has it surprised you that so many people, despite America's reputation of police brutality and institutional racism and white supremacy in general, we could do an entire show just naming names of black men and women and brown men and women who have been, you know, killed, you know, unarmed by the police. You know, as you said, Ayanna Stanley Jones, Oscar Grant, Sean Bell. What have been your thoughts around so many people that kind of, you know, were like incredulous, like were like shocked, you know, when this happened, and you know, and I don't know, it's kind of been weird to see how, you know, people have. You know, seem to just be ready to rally or to attend rallies, you know, right after, you know, the killing of a black person by the police. And then it kind of dissipates, you know, a month, 2 months afterwards. And then it's like, you know, waiting for the next one. And what's kind of been your reaction to people's just general incredulousness of, about surrounding this case? This is nothing, as you said, nothing new, but we could look into recent history. I mean, you talk about a 7-year-old black girl in Detroit, you know, 2010. I mean, you know, that's 2010. That's not the 50s with Emmett Till. And so,
right.
You know, what's kind of been your kind of take on that, the surprise of some people?
The first thing that comes to mind is the level or the depth of delusion in our society, so, and the mass of people that continue to live in a delusion, in a state of delusion, where they can be confronted with the facts of daily life and be shocked. They can be confronted with racism, the brutal, ugly reality of racism in this country, and be shocked, and then act as if it's a surprise. Act as if it came out of nowhere. Act as if it is an anomaly in our society. And you know what's troubling about that is, you know, we go back to the Barack Obama phenomenon, you know, during his campaign for president and then his eventual election to the office of president, you know, and there, you know, and I think the powers that be, particularly we saw this in the regressive media, they tried to gloss over the reality of racism in this country and say, well, now we've elected a black man as president, and so, you know, this is evidence that racism is a thing of the past in this country, you know, and I think a lot of people bought into that. A lot of people wanted to buy into that. A lot of Americans wanted to believe and still want to believe that this country is a land of equality and that people can be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. People want to believe that. People want to believe that America is a great society. People want to believe the rhetoric about the United States of America instead of dealing with the reality that is the United States of America, that it's a brutal, racist society. And so, you know, when I talk about the Emmett Till case, one of the things about the Emmett Till killing is that it set off a movement. You know, when we talk about the civil rights movement being set off, everybody points to Rosa Parks, and everybody points to the Montgomery Improvement Association and the bus boycott and Martin Luther King and so forth, and rightly so. Obviously, those were the pioneers of that movement, some of the pioneers. However, even talking to the players, those pioneers, they will point to the Emmett Till killing as a spark that really set off this indignation and helped propel it into what became a movement. So there were all these precursors. You know, it didn't just start in December of 55 when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. I mean, there were a lot of precursors. And those are the things that aren't in our history books and that don't make, you know, Black History Month and those kind of things. But the Emmett Till killing was one of those. And the difference between what happened after the Emmett Till killing and the events that followed it, I mean, Rosa Parks, the bus boycott, the sit-ins, and then, you know, just the, how it snowballed into the civil rights movement. And what you just described a moment ago, in terms of how we have these rallies, there's some outrage. You know, Sharpton gets on TV and you know, rallies are held and so on and so forth. But then it kind of dies out. And the difference is obviously that after the Emmett Till murder, it didn't just die down. It didn't die down. It eventually grew into this monumental movement that we call the civil rights movement. That is what is lacking today. After an Oscar Grant killing, after an Ayanna Stanley Jones killing, after a Sean Bell killing, you know, and again we could call the roll, like you said, after the Jenna Six, you know, but yet still things die down. And one of the reasons that is the case, Solomon, and we're gonna that's what's so important about the conversation we're gonna have with Carl Dix today, is that there is no revolutionary program in place, revolutionary organization in place today that can pick up that indignation, that groundswell of outrage, and turn it into a program. People go to rallies, and you know, but eventually they have to go back home and go back to school, go back to work, and so on and so forth. And there's no organized dissent, there's no organized movement or revolutionary organization that is in place and is widely, you know, accepted as the organization to go to, the go-to group, you know, and we're not seeing that today. But in our conversation with Carl, I hope we can start to reveal that there is an organization, there is a group, there is a movement that is viable, and maybe we can, you know, maybe this is the Emmett Till touchstone of the 21st century that will help propel us to a new movement, because that is what we need. You're right. After these rallies die down, after each incident, you know, things tend to go away, and then all of a sudden it pops up again, and then, all, you know, like you said, people are surprised, like, oh, my God, how could this happen? What we need is to continue that, all right? We need that permanent revolution, right, in a classic Marxist language, a permanent revolution. And so that's what we don't see, is we don't see the rhetoric of struggle that we saw in the 50s and 60s and even in the 70s, you know, everybody understood that, you know. Everybody was down for the struggle, right? We've lost that language. We've lost that rhetoric. We've lost the organization, the movement. And so that's the big difference between 1955 and 2012. And, you know, that's what we're going to tackle today and hopefully begin to really organize around a philosophy, an organization to begin a new movement in 2012 and going forward.
Right. That's a perfect segue. You know, as we welcome on the show to Your World News, once again, Carl Dix, who is a member, a longtime member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and a long, long, you can say a lifetime activist and organizer, community activist and organizer, who has been throughout the country doing amazing work. And one of the things that he's been working on for a while, he's not a reactionary, is work around mass incarceration and stop and frisk. And, you know, in New York City alone, you know, last year there were more than 700,000 stop and frisk, and the vast majority of them, you know, over 90%, it was Black and Latinos who were stopped and frisked. And the vast majority of them, you know, well over 85%, you know, were found to, I think it might even be 90% or so, that were found to be doing nothing wrong whatsoever, had no contraband on them whatsoever. So it's a real issue. And Carl Dix has actually even put himself in position where he, when protesting this, you know, he's been arrested, you know. So he's somebody who puts his actions front and center, you know, before his mouth. And so I'm going to welcome Carl Dix. Carl Dix, you're on Your World News with Solomon and Solomon Kamajan and Peter Fowler. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Am I coming through?
Yes. It sounds
okay.
Perfect. And
I want to thank you for having me on and allow me to get into this discussion with your World News audience.
Definitely. So, you know, as we get into it, I wanted to know if you wanted to give a contextual background of, you know, this epidemic, this social crisis that is left off of corporate media and therefore, unfortunately, is left off of the mind's eye of a lot of Americans, mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex. Can you explain a little bit more for our listeners why this is a crisis?
Let me just break this down real short and sweet in terms of what the situation is and what is the backdrop for it, what's driving it. I mean, a lot of your audience probably knows some things like 2.4 million people warehoused in prisons across the country, more than 60% of them Black or Latino, racial profiling, things like the stop and frisk official policy of the NYPD, where they target their law enforcement, particularly at Black and Latino youth, trapping them up in the criminal justice system and serving as a pipeline into that mass incarceration. And then official discrimination against people after they've been punished, after they've served their sentences and been released. I mean, just legally, you are discriminated against seeking employment. You can't get public housing. You can't get a government loan for education or to start a business or anything like that. I mean, and that's just written into the laws. That's what's coming down. That's what's happening. Why is it happening? And what they try to tell us is that it's happening because of the criminal activity of the people. But the real deal is that people have been criminalized. They've been criminalized because of the very workings of this system and the conscious policies of the U.S. imperialist ruling class. Let me start with the workings of the system. You're talking about capitalism, looking for the best rate of profit it could find. And part of how that happens is through globalizing the production process. And in the 1960s and 70s, they began and accelerated a process of moving manufacturing out of the U.S. to places like Mexico, Haiti, other places like that. Now it's even farther, Asia, farther into South America, where they can pay people a lot less than they paid people in this country and work them harder and in more dangerous conditions. Well, then that leaves you with folks who were drawn into the cities, especially Black people, but also Latino immigrants who were drawn into the country and into the urban areas by the manufacturing jobs with no way to legitimately survive and raise families. You know, and I like to say to people when they ask me about this, when you look at today's Black youth, this system exploited their ancestors as slaves. They exploited their great-grandparents as sharecroppers. They exploited their grandparents, putting them on the bottom tier of the factories, but they have no way to profitably exploit this generation of youth. They also remember what black youth did in the 1960s, being on the spearhead of rising rebellion and resistance that developed a revolutionary thrust, you know, through the work of groupings like the Black Panther Party, people like Kwame Ture, used to be called Stokely Carmichael, Imam Jamil Alameen, who used to be called H-Rap Brown back in the day. These people gave a revolutionary thrust to that, and they don't want to see that again. So they have moved to preempt that, in effect, waging counterinsurgency before the insurgency breaks out. And some people say, well, wait a minute, Brother Dix, you just talking off the top of your head. Can you prove any of this stuff? Yeah, we can tie this stuff down. A cabinet meeting in the early 1970s, Richard Nixon is quoted by two of his cabinet members as saying, the problem is the blacks, and we need to devise a solution that doesn't acknowledge that that's what we're dealing with. Their solution was the war on drugs and the war on crime. Wars which specifically targeted black people, but said they were targeting criminals and drug dealers. That's why you got things like the government telling you that about 80% of the drug users, the users of illegal drugs, are white, but that most of the people they bust for illegal drugs, and I'm just talking possession here, I ain't talking about dealers or nothing like that, most of the people they bust for possession are either black or Latino. That happens because they're targeting those people, criminalizing them. That's what we're dealing with, and people need to understand it that way. And the reason you need to understand it, I've been pushing out a slogan which I think people need to listen to, think about, and take up themselves: mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. Now, what I'm saying there is, when you look at what this system is doing, especially targeting black youth, Latino youth, things are on a genocidal track. That's where things are headed. And if we respond with silence, that's where we end up. Because when people think genocide, they think Jewish people, Nazi Germany, concentration camps, executions, massacres. But see, that didn't start that way. It started with the Nazis stigmatizing Jewish people, isolating Jewish people, stealing their property and undercutting their ability to thrive and survive. Then they started arresting them and took them to the camps. We're not to the end yet, but if you at the beginning, see, and what was missing in Germany was people standing up, both Jewish and non-Jewish, saying, we ain't taking this stuff. We're not letting this injustice go down. We have to make sure that we don't meet this injustice that's being meted out here with the same kind of silence, because you could end up in an analogous place, maybe not exactly the same, but in an analogous place. And as a revolutionary, I feel like I have to be a part of stopping that, in part because as a revolutionary, I love the people. That's why I put my life to fighting for their interest to get this system off their backs and get rid of it. And the other part is, if you're going to make a revolution, you can't let the people get beaten down to the point where they take anything. So we got to take on some of these attacks. We have to beat them back as part of building the strength, the consciousness and understanding and organization that could pull off a revolution here in the belly of the beast.
That's right. Peter?
Yeah. Carl, this is Peter Fowler. Good
How you doing,
show,
brother?
Comrade. You know, you started off that treatment of the situation by talking about the capitalist system and the profit motive and the historical development of what's called now, you know, neoliberal economic policies.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that whole part of the conversation is off the table when we talk about capitalism in this country. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, these capitalist motivations and these capitalist machinations, those are kind of things that are untouchable, they're unmentionables in public discourse, you know, in polite company, as it were. Why is that? Why don't we talk about capitalism and the nature of capitalism, and what would you like to bring to the table? If we were to start a conversation in the public discourse, if we could talk with just regular folks about the nature of capitalism and why it's problematic, you know, for the masses of people, for particularly for black and brown people, and why it's led to this criminalization and some of the other things you talked about, how would we begin that conversation? How would you move into that conversation about having a critical conversation about the nature of capitalism with in mind an eventual solution or alternative to that?
Okay. First thing I'll say is that this is something that I do, because you're right. That's been ruled off the table.
Yeah.
I am for not only putting it back on the table, but turning the doggone table over. Because, no, that table
right.
is one that the masses of people, their exploitation makes possible everything that's on the table, but they don't share in what's there. You know, so
yeah.
that table has to be turned over, and I would bring that conversation, that into the conversation, whether we're talking about mass incarceration, police brutality, the wars that this system is continually going into, the subjugation that they bring down on the sisters in this society, because that's what people need to understand and see. You can do it in a few different ways. One way is what I just laid out to you, which I'm drawing from a talk that I gave with the theme mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. And that talk is available online, and I encourage people to go to the Revolution Books New York website to check it out, because it gets in depth into that and gives the background to it. But you could also draw on, like Malcolm said, you talking capitalism, you talking blood sucking. Because that's how it works. And you can bring that to people and then get into how it actually is that. And when we're talking about the situation of black people in this country, people really got to go to the history, you know, because
right.
Trayvon Martin got gunned down by this vigilante wannabe cop. And people are saying, get out of the streets now. He's going on trial, let the system do its work. The only justification for saying something like that is either that you have no knowledge of history, or you are hoping that the people you're saying it to have no knowledge of history. Because, look, there's far too many Trayvons. There have been dozens of Trayvons just this year, 2012 alone.
Yeah.
You know, we could talk about hundreds or thousands, depending upon how far you want to go back. And it's laid out, because the other thing people say is, well, you don't know what happened that night. Well, I know enough about what happened. Look at the 911 calls. Zimmerman says Trayvon is suspicious. He must be on drugs. He's up to no good. These are quotes from Zimmerman. Why does he say that? Because he saw a young black man. That is the racial profiling that reflects and concentrates the way the whole criminal injustice system goes at black people. I don't need to know what happened in the minute between when Trayvon dropped his phone talking to his girlfriend and the cops come on the scene and see Zimmerman standing over Trayvon, because I already know enough. I know enough to know that this is the same as when the cop gets away with shooting down Amadou Diallo in a hail of 40-some bullets and said, I thought that wallet he was pulling out was a gun. Or when the cop gets away with shooting a brother who was sitting in his car in Brooklyn about to put the club, you know, onto his driver's, the steering wheel to keep it from getting stolen, and the cop thought that the club was a machine gun. Or the cop who shot a sister in Chicago when the undercover cops stopped. I'm talking an older case. I know about the Rebecca Boyd case. This sister, her car gets stopped by some dudes in civilian clothes. She takes the phone out and dials 911, and the undercover cops kill her because they claim they thought her cell phone was a gun. And basically, you can say all of this stuff because they were black anyway. so you were justified in thinking they were criminals. So when Trayvon gets murdered and those youth step into the streets and say, we are all Trayvon, they're right. And many of them know they're right. And then what we have to do with this is we have to seize on the opening to not only fight for justice for Trayvon, but to bring all the other Trayvons into the picture and into the discussion. The Trayvons who were murdered by the police, twice in fact, shot down on the street, and then their reputations were murdered when they started saying, oh, well, this young man had a juvenile record. He had been in jail. He had this, he had that, or she had this, she had that. As if the cop who gunned them down had some knowledge of that. All they had knowledge of was the black skin or brown skin of their victim. So we have to hit at that and hammer at that and bring into the picture the system that's behind it, how these cops are enforcing the unequal, exploitative, and oppressive relations of this capitalist system. And that's how you got to go at it. And in some situations, you know, when people are coming to get into it, you can go farther with it. In other situations, you got to be more like agitational, hitting at it just off of a particular point. But that's the point, to get people to the system that's behind it, to win them to see the need and the possibility for them to act, because that's very important. A lot of times people feel like they're up against all of this, but there's nothing they could do about it. And there was a certain way in which the Trayvon murder came together that gave people a sense that they not only needed to act, but that they could affect something. And we got to keep that going. That's part of why we had already called the April 19th National Day of Resistance to Mass Incarceration before Trayvon's murder had even happened, let alone before it hit the national news. But now it's happening tomorrow, April 19th. It's going to be happening in a number of different cities. We're going to bring Trayvon into the mix, but we're not going to just do a Trayvon thing. Because as important as it is to fight for justice for him, we have to bring out to people that these 2.4 million people who are warehoused in prison are not there mainly because of their criminals engaged in criminal activity. They are mostly there because they were criminalized. I mean, let's talk about nonviolent drug possession. More than a million people are in prison for that, the majority of them black, the next largest number Latino. Why did these people get arrested when the government itself tells you that most of the people who use the drugs that they're supposed to bust people for are white? It's because law enforcement goes after blacks or Latinos. Why is even nonviolent drug possession a crime as long as your drug doesn't happen to be alcohol? Because alcohol is actually a bigger social problem, but it's legal. It's because the system and what it wants to do, the people that it wants to criminalize, are the users of particular drugs. That's who they go in at. Even the crack and powder cocaine disparity that the Obama folks are trying to on the QT, you know, they don't want to blast it out there, but they've tried on the QT to spread among oppressed communities. Well, we did something, we removed this. Well, they didn't really remove it. They reduced it from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. And I got to do a Malcolm X on that. The knife was stuck 6 inches in your back. They decided to pull it out 3 inches and want you to reward them for a job well done. I'm like, get the knife out my back, clean out the wound.
Yeah.
Pay some reparations for having stuck it in there in the first place, and then we can talk about some stuff. No, but this is where we got to go with this, because this is what people need. You know, folks say to me all the time, you know, Carl, maybe if you took that revolution stuff and that communist stuff out, you'd be more effective. Mm-hmm. And I say, effective doing what? You know, you want to deal with symptoms but let the disease run rampant? And the disease is capitalism and imperialism. And, you know, you got to do stuff around the symptoms because the symptoms are killing people. But you have to get beyond the symptoms to the disease, because the symptoms will just continue to manifest themselves forever if you don't get to that disease.
That's right. That's right. And I wanted that. That's a good segue. I wanted to ask you this question. What would incarceration look like in a socialist communist country, what would it look like? Would it resemble? I'm being facetious, but would it resemble anything? Like, how would it contrast? How would it be a stark contrast to what we see here in the U.S. of A.?
Okay, that's a very good question. Because people need to be looking to what the future could be like. You know, it's not just enough to say that it's bad now. We want to say to people, things don't have to be this way, and here is a future that we could win. And even to break it down to here is what it would look like. That's why about a year and a half ago we produced a draft constitution for a future socialist republic in North America. And some people is like, well, wait a minute, man. We can't even get the idea of revolution out there, and you're talking about what it would look like. Yeah, that's exactly why we're talking about what it would look like, so that some of the people up against this mess could begin to look at how things could be different. And specifically in relation to incarceration, like, you make revolution in a country like the United States, you will end up with a situation where there's a few million people in prison, unless we have a lot of success beating them back on this mass incarceration thing. But even with that, there's still going to be hundreds of thousands of people in prison. What do you do about that? And part of it we're working on right now, because one thing that we do, we support this effort called the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund, which gets Revolution Newspaper, which is a weekly newspaper that the Revolutionary Communist Party puts out. We give that to prisoners free. We also, the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund also raises money to get revolutionary literature into prison. Through doing that, we're reaching into people, and some of them went in with some political consciousness, but some of them didn't, and discovered revolution on the inside. You know, because back in the 60s, it was a lot of revolutionaries going to prison. That's how revolution got into the prisons. But today, that's not the case. But we're trying to get revolutionary literature in there to develop groupings of revolutionary prisoners. That will be important. That would be important when a revolution does happen, because that would mean you'd have people on the inside who were with the revolution and could play a role in the transformation from mass incarceration to a new kind of society and world. Because as you would be making revolution and getting control of more and more territory away from the imperialist capitalist state structure, you would have these prisons with all of these people in them. If you were in positions to have revolutionary forces on the inside, then they could be constituted as a committee to review the situation of everybody there. You would not be able to, it would not be correct to just throw the prison doors open and let everybody out, because there are people in there who preyed on others and who, not so much their own fault because of the way the system works, left them with little in the way of choices in that. But if they're still on a tip of, I want to go prey on people, then the Revolutionary Society can't allow that to happen. What it would do, though, is it would review people's situations, and those who weren't on that tip, and especially those who were framed up and thrown in, you know, into prison because of the oppressive way that the system works, those people could be let out. People who had transformed themselves, like some of the brothers and sisters who have come to the revolution behind the walls now, they would definitely come out and be a part of building a new society. And we would also make clear to people, okay, here's the deal. We don't want to keep you in prison. We don't think this is necessary. The conditions that led you to adopt a lifestyle of preying on other people, that's being wiped out by the revolution. There will be economic opportunity, the ability to find work that's meaningful and contributing to the society. There will be equality throughout the society. There won't be the social degradation that black people, that immigrants, that other sections of marginalized people faced. You can become a part of building this new world. We put that to people and constantly re-review the situation so that as much as possible we'd be letting people out, not in an uncontrolled, anarchic way, but in a way of ensuring that people have transformed and aren't still on a tip of preying on others in society. But that would be a goal of the revolution. It would also be a measure of the revolution. And that's part of why we put this in the draft constitution, so people could look at it and both say, well, I don't think that's a good goal. I think you should just open the prison doors and let everybody out. And then they could make their argument about why. I think they'd be wrong because, you know, I've done time myself, and I'll do a Malcolm on this one too. Don't be shocked, because if you're in this society, you're in prison. You're just in minimum security. Behind the walls, it's more like maximum security. But anyway, I've done time myself, and I know that there are people in there who got used to preying on others, you know, who do it outside the prison, do it when they come in the prison, and it's going to take some struggle and persistence to break people from that approach. But we can't have it that we just let people out and let them prey on people while we're working on that. So that's how we would go at that.
You know, Carl, you talked about communicating, you know, with those individuals who are on lockdown now. And, you know, when I was working in that context, one of the things I tried to communicate to especially to the brothers, was that reality that they are being targeted, that they're in the system because the system preys on black and brown people and has criminalized a portion of our society. And my intent was to try to develop or to at least stimulate some level of political consciousness. And you just mentioned that. You talked about developing political consciousness. And I want to ask you to talk a little bit about what that means, what that looks like, what political consciousness is in a socialist Marxist context. Also, in also the broader context, is under the RCP, stands for Revolutionary Communist Party, and the RCP program calls, you know, throughout the document, calls for waging revolutionary war. But I think when we talk about war and we talk about revolution, it can be very intimidating to people. You know, we think about taking up arms and, you know, this militarized type of battle. Could you talk a little bit about this raising political consciousness and engaging in the revolutionary struggle and what a revolution would look like under an RCP type program, what a revolutionary war would look like, you know, and does it mean that we're going to be in the streets, you know, fighting in a military style battle with the police on a day to day basis, that kind of thing? Could you talk a little bit about those issues?
Okay, let me start with the point about political consciousness. What does that come down to? That comes down to people seeing that the outrages that weigh down on them in their lives stem from a source. It's rooted in the system. It's not their fault. It's not they made some mistakes, which is what you constantly get told. I mean, from Bill Cosby to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, you're hearing this thing about poor black people make poor life choices, and that's why they're in the mess that they're in. No, the system limits your life choices. They give you a choice between this bad one and that one. Poverty and getting involved in some hustle, legal or illegal, to try to survive. The system limits you to that. Well, you got to understand that. You also have to understand that the same source of your problems is the source of problems that are weighing down on other sections of people, that there's potential for alliances. Those alliances need to be brought to life for people. I mean, one thing we did when I was a part of forming the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality about 16 years ago, we made a point of giving a platform to the victims of police brutality and the survivors of those who had been murdered by the police to talk about what had happened to them. Because this is America, that came down to mostly black and Latino people. But then we also went to a lot of other people and said, you got to come out and stand with these people. You got to have their backs. And one thing that would strike people is the way in which the rallies on October 22nd would bring together people of different nationalities, people from different backgrounds, and people begin to see the possibility for alliances. So those are things you have to bring to people, but you also have to bring to them that there is a different way that the world could be. There's understanding and leadership for that. You got to bring to them the work that Bob Avakian's been doing to re-envision communist revolution, socialist society, and how it could be brought into being. You know, that's why we do what we do, to try to promote the book Basics, which draws from his 40 years of work, quotations and short essays, coming at the process of revolution, what its goal is, what it would look like from a number of different angles. That's what this thing of political consciousness looks like. And we are clear that a key ingredient in building that kind of consciousness is mobilizing people to resist the things that come down on them. We call it fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. That if it's just a discussion apart from any activity, it's going to have a lot less chance to make much difference to people. But if it is in relation to standing up and fighting back around the murder of Trayvon Martin, around the murder of Oscar Grant, around the murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones, and seeing those coming together as part of a larger picture, putting that together with the wars for empire and all of that, then people begin to see more clearly what they're up against, but also the potential to gather forces to go up against it and to make some difference. Now, what does revolution come down to? See, first off, we are making the revolution through the approach that we take to building resistance to mass incarceration, racial profiling, stop and frisk, and all of that. Revolution isn't just an event, it's a process, and it's one that's ongoing right now. But what does it come down to? And we have looked at this historically as well, and when it comes down to it, you would have to, in a country like this, rest, take away from the capitalists, their state structure, their enforcers, the power to dominate, suppress, and obliterate people's lives in the way that they do. And that is not a process that they're going to submit to nonviolently. Now, in saying that, people say, oh, Carl, you're violent. I say, no, the system is violent. You know, if they would recognize what they're doing to people is wrong and stop it, I would be tremendously surprised but happy about that. I don't expect that to happen. Frankly, if as the revolutionary movement develops and presents them with a whole thing of the potential power of the revolution, I mean, we might even do a thing of like, okay, you got 24 hours to give this up. And we'd be glad if they agreed to that, but we kind of think they won't, you know. But it comes down to, we are not lovers of war or military-minded people. We are emancipation-minded people and looking at what it's going to take to do that.
That's right. Yeah, I really like what you had to say about that. Brother Dix, I want to ask you a question. Folks that are listening right now, you mentioned the April 19th, Day of Action. How can people get involved? Where is the Day of Action going to be? And like I said, how can people get involved? And also, how can they, you know, get in contact with you to build with you and to you know, be a part of this sustained movement against mass incarceration that you've done so well in terms of building up?
Okay, look, this is very important because as we started out from the beginning, what we're up against in terms of mass incarceration, this is very important. So people got to get involved. So April 19th is a national day of resistance to mass incarceration. It's going to be happening in New York. It's going to be happening in Atlanta. Stuff is going on in L.A. and San Francisco. In Chicago, they even having a thing in Hawaii. That's how far out it's going. And people need to get in touch and get involved. If you're in any one of those areas, get in touch and get involved. If you're in some other area, you could do something where you are. and then let us know about it. And then even if you can't pull something together by tomorrow, this ain't over tomorrow. This has to keep going. So here are the ways to get in touch. Via email, stopmassincarceration, that's all one word, stopmassincarceration, @ymail.com. There is also two important sites for people to go to. One is A19Action, and that's 19 the number, A19Action.wordpress.com. And the other is BearWitnessProject.tumblr.com. And Tumblr is spelled without the E. And this Bear Witness Project is important because going forward, one of the things that we're going to be doing is we're going to be collecting the stories of people, stories about abusive policing, police brutality, police murder, racial profiling, but also stories about the conditions that people are up against in prison, the way in which people get railroaded into prison. Also stories about the way in which people transform their thinking in prison. Because that's another thing that the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund does. It gets a lot of writings from prisoners, and we want that to be more broadly known so that people can actually come to see who are the people in these prisons. They're not inhuman monsters, most of them. They are people who get trapped up in situations, end up in prison, and then are dealing with it the best they can. And some of them are changing their thinking and developing political and even revolutionary consciousness. And then we want to get stories from people about the discrimination they face outside the prison. So we both want to hear from people about their stories, and we want to connect with people who can help us record and post these stories and promote them so that they're more widely known about. We're looking at doing things like concerts against mass incarceration, calling on some of the people in the cultural arena who know or are coming to know what this problem is about, how significant it is, to say put some of your skills, your talent, and frankly your reputation on the line to try to deal with this horrific social problem. So people really need to get in touch and get involved. Get involved by tomorrow any way that you can, but even if you can't pull off getting involved by tomorrow, get in touch because we're going forward with this. I mean, when we started the campaign to stop, stop, and frisk, we weren't just doing a New York thing, and it wasn't about one particularly bad policy. When Cornel West and I issued that call for that civil disobedience campaign that got me in jail a few times, we made it that we're doing this as part of going at mass incarceration overall. And, you know, we're going to keep going on it.
That's right, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. I hope that we intend to post those links that you mentioned. We intend to post them on the Your World News site online, so our listeners we can go to those, get the word out. People can find those links at Your World News online.
Okay.
And really good to have you with us on the show today, Carl. I'd like for it to set the tone for signing off today, as we wind down the last half hour of the show, to try to put all this together and talk about the revolution and the revolutionary movement. And you laid out a number of things that people can do to get involved in the revolution and what revolution needs to look like. And let me ask you this about another movement that is on the ground presently. I want to get your perspective on it and your critique on it in terms of its potential and limitations and so forth from a Marxist perspective. The Occupy Wall Street movement has captured the attention of much of America, and we even see Occupy movement rallies and activity outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It's moved to all over the country and outside of the country. What is your take on Occupy Wall Street in terms of its potential to be a revolutionary movement? Is it the kind of thing that has a revolution, a true revolutionary program? Does it have a revolutionary philosophy? Or is it something else? What is your take on the Occupy movement? And then, you know, let's compare and contrast what an RCP-type philosophy would look like if there were that kind of inertia behind a communist socialist-led Occupy-type movement.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
All right. In terms of the Occupy movement, very important development because it brought large numbers of mainly young people into the streets and into a stance of resisting economic inequality in this country, which is an important problem, and questioning things that had previously been beyond the what you could really question and talk about. And what I'm talking about here is the obscene wealth by a small section of society and what that has to do with the rest of society that was hitting economic problems at this point. So capitalism, in a certain sense, as a subject to talk about, was getting put on the table along with economic inequality. And that's important. But Occupy does not have a revolutionary program. It has the potential to contribute to a revolutionary movement as people come to understand, well, why is this economic inequality here? How should we look at it? But this movement has to break through on a couple of things. One thing is it's got to break through in terms of understanding the U.S. as an imperialist phenomenon, not a country in and of itself, but a country that exploits people throughout the world. Because it would not be a positive development to, say, basically argue for a bigger cut of the imperialist pie. You got to actually argue for, let's get rid of this imperialist pie. We don't want more of the spoils of empire. We want an end to empire. That would be an important part of it. Also, it needs to break through on the thing of understanding that the 99% actually comprises people who face a lot of different situations, and that Occupy can't take a least common denominator approach to that and say, well, we're going to deal with economic inequality because all of us face that. No, you have to actually take up the oppression of black people. You have to take up the subjugation that women face in society. You have to actually deal with that if you're going to represent the interest of the 99%. And then also you have to address how are you going to change things. And these are things that Occupy has not yet broken through on. And we're not raising that from the thing of so Occupy is no good. It's still very important, played an important positive role in putting some questions on the table. But those questions have to actually be answered. I mean, because you have this thing of, well, we have to be horizontal. We have to be leaderless. We can't have leaders because that, you know, is replicating what we're going up against. And the question isn't leaders, but what those leaders represent. What kind of world are they fighting to bring into being? What kind of understanding are they trying to bring forward people to take up? And in a class-divided society, leadership is a requirement because people are not going to uniformly and evenly come to the correct understanding. It's something that you got to fight for. Because you guys were talking before I came on about why is it that we don't have more of a movement. And part of it is the earlier movement was gone at on a couple different levels. On one level, they violently suppressed the movement. And you can see that in terms of the murders of Black Panthers, especially targeting of leadership, throwing people in prison. But the other thing they did is they built up a buffer strata among black people, black mayors, black police chiefs, different things like that, which then gave some sustenance, some substance to the argument, well, can't you make it through the system? Look, he made it, she made it, up to the level now, well, look, you got a black president, what more can you want? Well, how about some liberation? How about some emancipation? We don't want a first black this or that. But that is a confusing thing to people, and you actually have to fight through on that. You have to bring out to people that that black president does not represent the interest of black people or any other oppressed people. He is the representative of the system that's oppressing you, you know, and then you point that out in terms of what activity he carries out. So you have to fight through on that, and you need leadership to do it. So that's what we have to say about Occupy, and it's something that you could go into more by going to the Revolution Newspaper website, which is www.revcom.us. That's revcom.us, because there's a statement, Reflections on Occupy by Bob Avakian, that goes more deeply into this question of Occupy and its positive role and potentially continuing positive role, but also the questions that are posed by it and need to be broken through on, and some beginning answers to those questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brother Dix. I really appreciate you coming on. I just want to, you know, thank you on behalf of Your World News and Peter Fowler for coming on the program. And we look forward to having you on again, and we will immediately, once the show is over, post this this show all over our Facebook network. So I'll send it to you and try to just really deluge, you know, Facebook and all of our social media with this interview, as well as the websites you gave, because people need to know about this National Day of Action.
All right.
So
I'll be talking with you in the future.
Definitely. We sure will, brother. We sure will.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. So, Peter, that was a great interview. And I just want to go with a little segue, Peter. I think you were out of the country when Glenn Ford dropped this scathing critique over, one of our former revolutionaries who is still around, but has really kind of exposed herself to really shedding a lot of her revolutionary outfit, you know, by way of, you know, just consuming large amounts of this. This Obama aid, you know, the Obama Kool-Aid, which is a very, 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 very powerful opiate. So I'm going to play this clip for you. I want to get your feedback on the interview, as well as what Glenn Ford says right here about Angela Davis.
The delusional effect that swept black America with the advent of the first black president has warped and weakened the mental powers of some of our most revered icons, and it has been painful to behold. Earlier this month, Angela Davis diminished herself as a scholar and thinker in a gush of nonsense about the corporate executive in the White House. The occasion was a conference on empowering women of color in Berkeley, California. Davis shared the stage with Grace Lee Boggs, the 96-year-old activist from Detroit. The subject was social transformation, but Davis suddenly launched into how wonderful it felt to see people dancing in the streets when Barack Obama was elected. She called that campaign a, quote, victory, not of an individual, but of people who refused to believe that it was impossible to elect a person, a black person, who identified with the black radical tradition, unquote. There was a hush in the room, as if in mourning of the death of brain cells. Angela Davis was saying that Barack Obama is a man who identifies with the black radical tradition. She said it casually, as if black radicalism and Obama were not antithetical terms, as if everything he has written, said, and done in national politics has not been a repudiation of the black radical tradition, as if his rejection of his former minister, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, was not a thorough disavowal of the black radical tradition. In his famous 2008 campaign speech in Philadelphia, Obama blamed such radicals for compounding the nation's problems. He viewed people like Reverend Wright as having been mentally scarred by battles of long ago, who were unable to see the inherent goodness of America as he did. This is the man who said he agreed with President Ronald Reagan that the 60s were characterized by excesses. Can anyone doubt that Obama considers the historical Angela Davis herself to be part of the political excesses of the 60s and early 70s that he so deplores? And that is the saddest part of the story. Angela Davis, who retired as a professor of the history of human consciousness in 2008, seems not to be conscious of the fact that she is repudiating herself, her history, her comrades, all in a foolish attempt to artificially graft a totally unworthy Barack Obama onto the black radical tradition, a place he not only does not belong, but most profoundly does not want to be. This is the guy who declared at his first national broadcast opportunity that there is no black America, only the United States of America. How, then, did Angela Davis connect Barack Obama to the black radical tradition? She didn't, because even an icon cannot do the impossible. Instead, Davis quickly told the crowd in Berkeley that we need to figure out how to prevent somebody like Mitt Romney from getting elected. But the vast majority of black people are going to wind up voting for Obama anyway, because he's not white and Republican. There's no need to pollute the proud tradition of black radicalism by dipping the corporate warmonger Obama into the historical mix. In doing so, Professor Davis has soiled herself and done a terrible injustice to black history and tradition. And the biggest shame of all is she has diminished herself and insulted our people for the sake of a president who doesn't give a damn for their history or their future. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Well, Pete, I'll let you reflect on that as well as the interview, because I know you're a little bit startled at that news.
Yeah, I am. I've got to put myself together. But yeah, that's very, very troubling to say the least. And a couple of things, and I'll try to put them together in terms of that bit of tragic news on Angela Davis and the interview, because they both the interview with Carl Dix and the report from Glenn Ford about Angela Davis's loss of sanity, they both raise more salient questions. They both expose some real issues, you know. And the interview with Carl, he helped us to raise some more questions and to expose the real issues that are at hand and must be confronted. Obviously, the big one is capitalism, you know. We've got to expose capitalism for what it is. And the Occupy movement, as Carl mentioned, doesn't adequately do that. And then another thing that Carl said, and I could talk with that comrade all afternoon. And one of the things that he mentioned that is an interview or a conversation all in itself was how the liberation movement from the 50s, 60s, and 70s was violently attacked by the domination system. So it was crushed, you know, and that is actually the beginning of this prison explosion that really started around the early 70s when the black radical tradition began to really take to the streets, and the domination system replied very violently, you know, and the prison system is the outgrowth of that backlash. And that's a big reason why we don't have an organized movement today, is because the domination system crushed it. The Black Panther Party was the great example of that, and Carl mentioned that. That's an excellent example, but just one example of an organization, a revolutionary party, that was crushed by the state It, you know, in a preemptive, well, it wasn't preemptive one because the Panthers were already organized, but it was, but it also was preemptive in that it cut off any future development by continuing this, or by creating this process of incarceration and criminalizing an entire group of people. And the other thing about that concept of criminalization, I just want to mention briefly, is that it doesn't just stop with radicals. It doesn't just stop with black folks. It doesn't just stop with brown and black and non-white people in this country. But criminalization, we see is a very serious tactic by the part of the state. You know, in this police state that we're living in, criminalization is the justification, obviously, for incarceration. And one of the more troubling developments lately is the criminalization of homeless people. And there is a movement that is just beginning to get generated to fight the criminalization of homeless people. All across the country, we're seeing laws, and most of these are very recent laws that are being enacted that criminalize things like sitting down in a public place, lying down, sleeping in public, these kind of things. And so, you know, it's essentially a crime to be homeless, which is, of course, is the homeless person is simply a victim of, you know, this brutal social system that we call capitalism, and so it's a real tough spot to be in. So those are some issues that we need to take seriously, you know, that Carl raised. And then the Angela Davis thing, I don't know what to say about that. Obviously, you know, Glenn said it better than I could. You know, how could Angela Davis, somebody who was in the thick of the liberation movement, possibly say Barack Obama and black radical tradition in the same sentence?
Exactly.
And you know what, I think that goes back to what I said at the top of the show about living in a delusion and about really wanting something so bad that you just make it to be true in your mind, at least, you know. And I think that Angela Davis demonstrates something that we see among a lot of black folks, is that they want liberation, they want justice, they want equality so bad that they say, okay, we've got a black president, so it must be so, you know. But, you know, that stuff, Ed Carl said this, you know, this stuff, liberation and equality and justice, they don't happen. They're not just given to us. But, you know, it's a constant struggle, it's a constant fight. You know, so Carl Dix and Angela Davis situation, they both raised some real important issues that we need to take seriously and to continue the conversation on about visioning that alternative society. You know, that's another thing that Carl Dix said very, very well, very clearly, is that there is an alternative, and we just need to have the imagination and the audacity to envision an alternative society. So, we need to, you know, let's go from there.
That's right. And you know, and another thing is you know, for the, you know, some of these nitwits out there, these delusional folks that, you know, that like to defend capitalism, you know, tooth and nail without trying to critically think, you know, and I've heard this before, you know, folks like, oh well, you know, yeah, the prison industrial complex, it's a problem, you know, mass incarceration is a problem. You know, but you don't have to go on capitalism. You know, capitalism is not the problem. It's such,
right.
You know, it's just such, and I'm like, you fool. Like are you not thinking that when you see corporations like CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, and Geo Group, you know, formerly known as Wackenhut, you know, owning these large swaths of prisons coast to coast, and that you can buy, you can literally, you know, if you have the money, buy shares in their companies, you know, on Wall Street, you know, that lets you know that their stock, you know, their stocks either go up and down based on how many beds are filled in these prisons, these jails, these juvenile detention centers, and yes, and now they're building, you know, detention centers for so-called illegal aliens. What a racist, stupid, you know, misnomer term. If there's any legal aliens in this country. It's white folks of European extraction. You know, these folks
right.
are Spanish speaking. You know, that are you know in your state, of Arizona, New Mexico. These folks are the descendants of the original, you know, owners of America, the original landholders that had this land in a perfect balance. You know what I'm saying? Only eating as much as they needed, you know, from season to season, and so forth. With the same with the bison, and using every last part of every single bison that they killed for, you know, for food and for clothing
yeah.
and for shelter and for needles and so forth and you know, and then you have and enter, you know, stage right, you know, these European thugs that just came through and just ran roughshod, you know, killing and destroying everything, man, woman, child, and animal and vegetation and land, you know, in their process. And so, you know, it's sick. You know, it's sick. You know, the history of this country that is not taught, and it's sick the fact that Americans are so, as you said so many times before, Peter. You said it simple. The way you explain Americans, it's a delusion. They're delusional. I mean, you would have
Absolutely.
To be delusional not to think, not to equate, you know, the prison industrial complex. As one of the dirty, you know what I'm saying, offspring of a capitalist beast, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. You know.
Exactly.
Just
to reiterate for our listeners, you know, to because obviously the brief time that we had Carl Dix on the show, we you know barely scratched the surface on. The crisis of mass incarceration, and even less so on the alternative vision of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So I just want to reiterate and encourage folks to visit the Revolutionary Communist Party website. And it's revcom.us, revcom.us. Go to that website. They've got the Constitution, a draft that is right there online. You can read through that and actually follow up on some of the things that we just were able to touch on and much, much more that we weren't able to touch on. And I think that's a good place to start a conversation or start your own education on what capitalism actually is, the domination system that we call capitalism. So I hope folks will follow up on if you're intrigued by the interview today. Go to that website, check it out, and also if you're listening today, you can go there and find out about the events on tomorrow, on the April 19th day to break silence. So check out revcom.us.
Definitely. And Peter, do you want to, before we leave, do you want to give folks a sneak peek in terms of what one of our next programs is going to be, the program that you were thinking about launching the second part, phase of this, which has to do with capitalism, socialism. Do you want to, you know, explain to folks what they have to look forward to on one of our next programs?
We're going to continue this conversation. Having Carl on the show I think opened a door for us, and we need to walk through that and actually have that conversation about capitalism. So we'll be continuing that conversation on Your World News about what capitalism is. We'll be presenting a critique or a number of critiques on capitalism, and making a very conscious effort on our regular broadcasts to make the connection between the particular crisis that is the topic for the day to the capitalist system itself. Because, like you mentioned earlier, when folks, you know, they're down with the struggle for against mass incarceration, but they don't want to bring capitalism into the conversation. Well, it's impossible. And so we need to be intentional about drawing the lines and connecting the dots between all of these symptoms of domination that stem from the capitalist system, such as mass incarceration, such as the imperialist wars for resources that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that the U.S. is now amping up for in Iran, against Iran, the Iranian people, make those connections, talking about the criminalization of different populations in the United States and how that serves the domination system, why that is a direct result of a capitalist ideology. So that's what we'll be talking about. We'll definitely take at least one show to cover some of those things in much more detail. And then I hope in the future we'll be more intentional about making direct connections and identifying those parallels between the particular crises that we're treating and the capitalist system that spawns all of these humanitarian crises.
Right. Thanks so much, Peter. And this has been a great show. Thanks for everyone that's listened to the show, whether it's live or wherever you are and whatever time it is that you're listening to the show, if it's on archive. Thanks for tuning in. And look for Peter and I for our next program just by making sure that you sign up through Blog Talk Radio to follow our show. And if you do, you'll get updates in terms of all of our subsequent programs. So I want to take us out with a couple of comrades of mine called PayShare, and this is called The Real Criminals. For Peter Fowler, I'm Solomon Kamajan, and this is Your World News.
2006, we all faced with the same bullshit. Black cop, white cop, it don't matter. Bad cop, yo. A cop killer, yeah. Strictly murder, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminals. When a cop kills, strictly murder, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they the real criminals.
Yo, the gang in blue steal the pigs, true. Now they got tear gas and Billy Club too. And if you club you, don't run from the challenge. Just cock back your hammers and pop one of the cabins. The average policeman lacks proper respect, so I get respect back with the Glock and attack. Before they had me on the deck, so blocking my neck. He'll catch this right hook and get dropped with the left. Who'd expect my enemy to look like me? Black cops showing off, he's just a crook like me. It's like we ignorant to our rights, we all seen. We should've left. Bust our heat for New Orleans and then left. Bust the phone for the Gulf Coast. They left people there with no hope, cause we poke up. Most cops murder us and get a slap on the wrist. Uncle Tom MC scared to rap about this.
A cop killed, yeah. Strictly murdered, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law, yeah.
We're
criminal.
In the middle of a war. Bars on your windows and doors. Your home is a prison. The way we live in is poor. The Lord got gas. Act like we can't hold heat. That's the reason I speak. My folks can't stay sweet. Patrol our own streets. We're living in a police state. Y'all live behind steel gates to try to feel safe. Still race wars erupt. All my brothers are stuck behind prison bars. Evil scars and third eye shut. Rise up. You gotta make the revenue stack before physical combat. Your minds are attacked. So I got stacks of books. Getting my mind chiseled. Trying to stay wise. Exercise my mental. It's simple mathematics. My music is graphic. So this is what you get when the beast attacking. Get at us if you're ready to ride. This is what here's for. All my soldiers die. I'm never gonna hide.
A cop killer, strictly murder, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they're the real criminals. A cop kills, strictly murder, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop kills me, the loss is minimal. Police is hiding behind the law because they're the real criminals.
Yo, the new gang mentality, government immorality, worldwide brutality. I know they probably mad with me. Sad to see children living with lies told to the public. Cause we living with eyes closed to the fact that police get away with murder every day. Never pay for the people they hurt. A word up, the Patriot Act, that's the right fact. Now pigs come in the crib and don't have to ask, or even flash a warrant. They at war with my folks, killing people cause they broke all over the Gulf Coast. Most folks obey the law, clearly might get stopped. And it's a 50-50 chance that you might get shot. And we not shocked to hear about cops getting shot, cause we know how they do when they come on the block, making it hot. And when money stops, it's critical police hide behind the law cause they the real criminals.
A cop killer, strictly murder, they say wrongful death. When I kill, I'm an animal with no morals left. If a cop
excuse me, the loss is minimal.